Is Earth the only livable planet in the universe?
What if Earth was not even the only livable planet in our galaxy?
Could we someday be living on another planet?
What if we lived on a super Earth? Today on What If Discussed. Welcome to What If Discussed. I'm Peter Smeichen.
And I'm Richard Garner. So, Pete, if you had to describe our planet, Earth, in one word, what would that word be?
Well, I'm going to guess this is a trick question, and you're asking me this because of the title of our show today, which is Super Earth. So I'm going to say, the Earth is super.
The Earth is super.
Yes.
But it is not a super Earth, according to current scientific definition.
Okay.
So again, super Earth is a term that, you know, you might have heard of over the last really, you know, few years. It's not much older than that. It's during this time where we're, you know, finding a lot of exoplanets. Super Earths obviously meet a certain category, and I won't continue to speculate. I'll go to our friends at Universe Today, and their definition of a super Earth is a planet with more mass than Earth, but less than a larger planet like Uranus or Neptune. So you could have super Earths made of rock and metal or even ice and gas. These planets could have oceans and atmospheres or made of nothing at all, like, you know, except maybe hydrogen or helium. But the goal, of course, is to find a rocky super Earth that's located in a habitable zone. So super Earths aren't necessarily conducive to human life, but we're looking and we're continuing to look to find that perfect sort of super Earth that might also be conducive to human life.
Yeah, well, we're not there yet.
Not there yet.
But it does seem like in the past couple of years, I mean, I had never heard the term habitable zone or Goldilocks mm-hmm. zone before, and it seems like in the past couple of years, every other week, we're hearing about a new planet that could potentially house human life.
Yes.
Wow.
4,000 or so exoplanets, I believe, something around that, have been discovered over the last X amount of years. It feels like we're going to be discovering more as we go. But yes, it's gotten to the point where it's not even like a big, it's like number 7 on the list of news stories on the site. Yeah, we discovered a new exoplanet. Before, it was like, oh my God, we discovered an exoplanet. Now it's like, we're like, meh, whatever.
Yeah. Is it possible to live there? Hard for us to speculate, but you know who can?
Our guest today?
That's right. Let me introduce you to him. Jack Madden graduated in 2014 from Franklin and Marshall College with a BA in astrophysics. While at FNM, he worked with Dr. Fronfield Crawford on an extragalactic pulsar survey and also on pulsar identification algorithms. He's now a fourth-year PhD student in the Department of Astronomy at Cornell University.
Dr. Madden, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So we've heard a lot over really the past few years about exoplanets and the discovery of exoplanets and super Earths. So it's an exciting time, obviously, to be an astronomer. But for those people who aren't astronomers, it is a bit of a, I don't know, an enigma that all super Earths are exoplanets, but not every exoplanet is a super Earth. Do I have that right?
Yes. Yeah. And I apologize on behalf of all exoplanet scientists for the confusion. We sort of use these terms loosely because we know that they're going to change over time. So we started discovering all these objects, we needed a name, and we went with super Earth, and that term has evolved. So the term is really how you might describe Jupiter and Saturn as like gas giants. It's sort of a subset, a category of planets that is defined roughly by size. So the term super Earth, it used to mean anything really between an Earth-sized planet and a Uranus-sized planet. But now we've really narrowed that down to mean something that's terrestrial, something rocky like Earth, that goes up to about 1.75 Earth radii. And that gives us a mass between 1 and maybe 6 or 7 Earth masses.
How have advancements in technology, and specifically telescope technology, changed the game in searching the galaxy for exoplanets, super Earths? What can we expect from the launches of the future super telescopes? Because a few are coming up, right?
Yeah, so astronomy is really driven by the design of telescopes. you know, we've seen thousands of exoplanets discovered with the capabilities of Kepler. TESS is going to find 1,000 more. So we're really looking now towards characterizing these exoplanets. So we have all these planets. What do we do now? We want to learn more about them. We don't know too much just from their detection. We know that they exist. But what are they made of? What are they like on the surface? And the real push now is for detecting and looking at the atmospheres of these super Earth and rocky planets like the Earth. So that's where these huge telescopes come in, and they're really gargantuan. These 30 meter class ground-based telescopes and these sort of 10 meter class space-based telescopes that are still concepts. And those will have the capabilities of learning more about super Earths.
Yeah, it's an exciting time to be an astronomer, and your work specifically uses Earth's own evolution to help with the discovery, almost as a template to help discover and find super-Earths. Can you explain to us how that works?
Yeah, so part of my research involves modeling the climates of potentially habitable exoplanets. This allows us to sort of know what to look for and know what to expect as these measurements start to come in. And when you're dealing with habitable planets, we really only have the Earth as the only example that we can build our models off of. So when you build these models, you need sort of this ground truth to make sure you're doing it right. And we don't want to venture too far away from that, just so we know that we're doing it, you know, within the bounds of reason based on the only example we have. But the trick is that the Earth's atmosphere has changed over time. It's been quite different in the past, but still inhabited by life. So we can look at the geologic record and see what the atmosphere was like on Earth in the past and use those as templates to a point where we don't have just one example of a habitable planet, but we have several, but it's just the Earth through time.
What do we know currently about exoplanets in terms of some of their more basic but vital measurements, like oxygen and atmosphere levels?
Yeah, so these measurements are really hard to make. We've mainly just found a bunch of exoplanets, and the sort of special cases, the largest ones and the hottest ones are things we can actually get information about in terms of composition. We haven't really looked at the compositions of Earth-like planets, very small, colder planets. So we don't know too much there, and that's where these big telescopes are going to come in. We do have some information about like Jupiter-sized planets and what their atmospheres are structured like and what those are made of, but nothing at the scale of an Earth-like planet.
So let's talk gravity, shall we?
So, yeah.
Well, I mean, in this particular case, it's probably, and you correct me if I'm wrong, you know, the most important variable we're dealing with. We know how important gravity is as a force in the universe, and obviously as it affects life on this planet. But one of the things we also know is gravitational pull. The bigger it is, it affects, you know, things like asteroids coming into your orbit. We know about mass extinction events, the dinosaurs, et cetera. Are some of these super-Earths potentially living with maybe so much gravitational force that it might get in the way of them developing long-term evolution and civilization because maybe they're getting pounded by asteroids? Is that an oversimplification?
No, that's definitely an interesting question. And I think there's a lot of competing factors. Yes, when you have a larger planet, it's going to have a greater sort of sphere of influence gravitationally. So it'll pull in more asteroids. And as they're coming in, they're going to speed up more because you have a greater gravitational pull. So they'll be faster than if they were coming into Earth. You have to, though, consider that the main effect on the speed of an asteroid is really going to be the relative motion of the planet and the asteroid as they orbit their host star. So the planet's going to be orbiting around, the asteroid's going to be orbiting around too, and those velocities can be much higher than if you were to sort of just drop an asteroid to a super Earth. There's also the effect that these super Earths might have thicker atmospheres, which can really put the brakes on a meteor. But so I think that expanded gravitational influence is really going to cause some interesting cases for asteroids and extinction events, which could be greater.
And so gravity has not only effect on space debris like asteroids and whatnot, but tell us about the effect of gravity and how it pertains to like water and magnetic fields and us.
Yeah, so there's a lot of theories floating around about this, and it's really fascinating. I think it's the most fascinating thing about super Earths right now is the strange conditions they can create for these different things just based on their increased gravity. So things like the magnetic field, if you have more mass on a planet, you might actually end up freezing, sort of solidifying its dynamo in its core, which actually could reduce its magnetic field. There's theories maybe that there's could be other elements that could create a magnetic field for these planets, but you might end up with a smaller magnetic field. In terms of geologic activity, a larger planet's going to have more internal heat. You might have more activity on the surface as that heat is trying to escape. And then water is a really interesting thing for super Earths. I think it's one of the most fascinating parts of this to theorize about is that we're finding some super Earths that might have a large fraction of water, so much greater than Earth. So these planets might be covered in a very deep ocean. And what that does when you have a deep ocean on a very massive planet is you might actually get ice to start to form at the boundary between the ocean and the seafloor. And this ice is very strange ice. It's not like ice we're used to, where the molecules are cooled down and you know, crystallize into a solid. This ice is formed just by the pressure alone. So the molecules are just packed so tightly together that they form a solid. And this can have some really strange consequences for things like the evolution of life, how plate tectonics are working, and a whole host of different cycles that affect the atmosphere. Because you're sort of creating this layer between the ocean and the seafloor that's impenetrable. Usually water can sort of interact with the rock at the seafloor. You can transfer all sorts of chemicals. Life can get started there. But once you put this layer down, you're sort of stopping a lot of these cycles, and it can have some pretty disastrous consequences if you think of life starting on the seafloor or how a planet might regulate its temperature in terms of these like feedback cycles.
Well, I mean, it's a very interesting time, like I said, to be an astronomer because we're probably at the tip of the iceberg in terms of the discovery going forward with, like you talked about, the improved technology, improved telescopes, more exoplanets, more super Earths. But still, what you've also sort of pointed out is the question still remains whether any of the conditions on some of these super Earths are conducive to at least creating life that we would understand to be quote unquote intelligent life. But still more to unpack as we go forward in the years and decades to come. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us today to shed light on what's really fascinating, a fascinating time to be alive, to be honest. Where can people find more about your fascinating work?
Yeah, so you can look for my website, jmadden.org, on Instagram and Twitter, or you can just Google me to find my recent papers.
Fantastic.
Keep looking in the universe for us, and obviously we hope that maybe one day we're all talking about that great discovery by Dr. Jack Madden. And if you're thinking of planet names, Peter Richard, just to consider. Okay, thank you, and we'll catch up with you down the line.
Thanks so much.
Yep, thanks.
So yes, lots to discover out there in the galaxy, exoplanets, super Earths, but for the time being, our focus is still here on Earth with our everyday issues and our everyday problems. One of those being, I don't know, finding insurance.
Well, yeah, it's you're right, because when you find the right policy, you save big bucks, and that's what we all want to do. With everything going on right now, Richard, in the world, exoplanets aside, people are asking, is it even possible to buy life insurance? Mm-hmm. Are you asking that question?
Well, it's a good question because in normal times, you'd say, of course it is. But now, you know, things change when, let's say, risk goes up. People might be wondering, is anybody even selling life insurance? And if they are, at what cost? But obviously, they would need somebody to help guide that process, not only to find it, but also, I guess, to find the right one.
Mm-hmm. Policy Genius. Yeah, you can buy life insurance during a pandemic. And if you have loved ones, depending on your income, you definitely should. Policy Genius is an insurance marketplace. They're in contact with insurance companies on their platform every day, keeping track of all the changes in the market so that you don't have to, which means you can get covered quickly and for the best price. Here's how it works. Policy Genius compares quotes from the top life insurance companies all in one place. It just takes a few minutes to compare quotes from the top insurers to find your best price. This doesn't save just legwork, like I say, price. You know how much you could save, Richard?
$1,500.
How do you know this?
Well, I'm a genius.
You certainly are.
I'm a policy.
You could save $1,500 or more each year by using Policy Genius to compare life insurance policies. So if you're one of the many people looking to buy life insurance right now, but you're not sure where to start, head to policygenius.com. Policy Genius will find you the best rate and handle the process completely. They'll get you and your family protected and give you one less thing to worry about.
And again, plenty of things to worry about these days.
Every day.
Which is why, but why I enjoy, you know, a show like today, because we get to sort of zoom out, maybe out of our everyday issues, and be able to talk and think about things like exoplanets, supers, etc. And we're lucky enough to talk to people like Dr. Jack Madden, who has sort of opened our eyes to a few different things. I don't know about you, but I mean, first of all, the excitement about what is to come, not what's been discovered with these super telescopes that are coming down the line. I mean, I can't even imagine. I'm almost like a kid in Christmas, because you can just sort of, you can speculate, but as far as where we're at now, what we understand, I don't know, one of the biggest takeaways for me is that, you know, kind of pump the brakes here. The gravity, everything else. I think the initial exoplanets meant other Earths that were habitable, like for a lot of people. Super Earth sounded like better Earths.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't
misleading.
Sound like that.
It's a misleading nomer.
Yeah, it's
a misnomer.
Misnomer, if you will. But it does sound like, in the end, the astronomers that are working through different models and obviously technology that we have now have been able to speculate enough things about atmosphere, oxygen levels, and gravity to feel pretty confident that there's no discoveries as of yet where we could say, well, there's probably an intelligent species there at this particular time, but TBD. So yeah, lots to think about. Maybe even more questions than answers, or at least for me, that's usually the case. We go down some of these rabbit holes and all of a sudden the light bulbs start to go off. Dr. Madden, we've heard the expression, I'm sure you've heard the expression more than the average person, but the Goldilocks zone, right? That sort of perfect sweet spot of just far enough away from your star, obviously water, a few other things to be quote unquote habitable.
Not too hot, not too cold.
Not too hot, just like the porridge. And, you know, this is what we've always applied to finding quote-unquote intelligent life. And what do we mean when we say that? Human life,
human,
right?
Yeah,
but what we've also discovered over the years recently here on Earth as well as elsewhere are these extremophiles, you know? Life that can form in a volcano at 3,000 degrees centigrade and in the ice in Antarctica. So it would probably change the game on what these super Earths require to create life, maybe not life as we know it. How does that affect the game and kind of the way you guys look at that possibility and theorizing what constitutes habitable environments for life?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And for super Earths, that main effect is that gravity, the increased gravity. There's really nothing that's telling us that life couldn't evolve in a higher gravitational field. We see life on Earth, like you said, in such extreme environments. It doesn't seem like increasing gravity a little bit would preclude life from evolving there. I think, though, that there's those secondary effects of, like, you know, that ice boundary at the surface of the subfloor of the oceans, how those affect the formation of life. If you theorize that life started at hydrothermal vents, now you have to contend with a huge layer of ice there. Things like magnetic field, how crucial was that in developing intelligent life, life on the surface of a planet? So there's all these secondary effects that are really interesting that complicate things, but there's nothing telling us that it couldn't happen.
Well, let's say for the sake of argument that intelligent life has evolved on a super Earth and is ready to explore space, just like we are. How difficult would launching a rocket from a super Earth be given that intense gravitational difference?
Yeah, so it would be quite a bit harder. If you have a bunch more mass, you're going to need a lot more fuel to change your velocity enough to get out of that gravitational well. It could be quite difficult. But, you know, working in science as a theorist, I've sort of learned to not underestimate engineers and their capabilities. So I would imagine if you know, some intelligent life form wanted to get off of an exoplanet, a super Earth, they could figure out a way to do it, but it would be definitely harder.
We talked earlier about the, you know, these imminent new super telescopes, James Webb, I think in 2021. I think there's some more coming up down the line. And I, you know, so I picture, you know, let's say, I'm sure you don't fall asleep every night dreaming of exoplanets. Maybe you do. I don't know. But you must be excited about what that potential creates for everybody in your field going forward. What excites you as a young astronomer now about the future of exploring exoplanets and super Earths?
Yeah, it is a really exciting time with these telescopes coming up. I remember first learning about these massive instruments and learning that they'd actually have the capability of detecting biosignatures around Earth-like planets. And that's a real possibility in, you know, a decade's time. We might have a few telescopes that are capable of that. So that's incredibly exciting to be living now at this time where we can actually get some solid evidence to answer those questions of whether we're alone.
Yeah, so that's right now. But say, fast forward 100 years, how much do you think we're going to know about super Earths and exoplanets in general?
Oh, wow. 100 years from now is quite a long way. I mean, we'll have really good understanding of the compositions of these objects. We'll have good data on what their atmospheres are made out of. We might even be able to tell if there's intelligent life there. But it's hard to say. I mean, there's ideas floating around of, you know, sending chip satellites to nearby solar systems to see more closely, but it's hard to tell.
Well, it certainly sounds like a lot of the sci-fi we might have grown up with will be less fi and more sci, because we're on the verge of stuff that, again, we couldn't have imagined 20 years ago, and it's people like yourself that are obviously, you know, blazing the trail forward and doing the work. So we're really excited, to know that this is, you know, not just a year away, 5 years away, but even 10 years away, some of the exciting things that people like yourself are going to be doing. So thanks for joining us today and sharing some of that with us. And we'll catch up with you down the line.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Well, okay, Richard, I'll ask you the same question. Where do you think we'll be in 100 years when it comes to our understanding of the galactic neighborhood?
Well, I mean, I think I'm not a breaking news. I'm not a professional astronomer, nor am I a highly respected doctor of astronomy. So I think I have the leeway to be a little more, let's say, optimistic, but having said that, I mean, you could tell Dr. Madden was also, you know, pretty excited about the possibilities. In 100 years, I think we will have cracked space travel at a level that we will be able to go to these planets. Manned, I'm not 100% sure, but as he was talking about, there's already talk about, you know, being able to send these like micro satellites to planets.
Chip satellites
and stuff. If we're talking about that right now, and you use that sort of Moore's law of technological you know, exponential increase going forward. It's hard for me to imagine in 100 years we can't literally take a picture of a planet from that planet. You know, we were sending probes in the 70s to Saturn. Does it mean manned or human space travel to some of these planets? I don't think so, but I certainly imagine there'll be way more exoplanets, way more super-Earths, and way more possibly habitable planets.
You were saying earlier when we were talking that, you know, perhaps we can get a shot from one of these telescopes right into the bedroom of some teenage boy on exoplanet 65938.
I love that idea. But I mean, it's very difficult. You know, the thing I default to is when somebody says, okay, picture a color that doesn't exist.
Right. We don't know what we don't know.
You can't, no matter how, it's so abstract, the mind can't work that way. So we can't really sort of get to, but if you use the example of just, you know, trillions of planets in this galaxy, and then what Hubble's shown us about trillions, hundreds of billions of galaxies that we can see, what are these new super telescopes going to show us, Pete? I mean, they're going to show us at least by numbers that it's so improbable that we just won the lottery here on the blue marble.
And we're the only
one. And that we're the only one. Now, having said that, some of it was stuff that Dr. John Madden or Jack Madden talked about, which is it really does require, at least for life as we know, perfect conditions. Even some of these super Earths, their gravity doesn't work for different things.
But does it? Because, like we were saying, even on Earth, you know, life has formed in the most inhospitable
yes.
of areas. So I was sort of like thinking when he was talking about the slush at the bottom of the ocean, you know, life couldn't form there. Well, maybe life, a different kind of life exists that we haven't even conceived of,
well,
and that can.
I agree 100%. And it makes you think about, you know, some of these, let's say Arthur C. Clarke, not so much, but certainly George Lucas and or, you know, Gene Roddenberry and the people that whose job it was to try to envision what other life would look like. Well, you see, whether it's the, you know, the bar scene in Star Wars or a lot of these other sci-fi, they do demonstrate different life that looks more lizard-like or you know, more like fish or whatever it is. They might be bipedal. In some cases, they're not. But this idea that, let's say, the sort of the human that we know about, yes, that might require these conditions, but it might also be that some intelligent life has evolved in conditions that would far outstrip what we could imagine here. Mm-hmm. Now, are they going to be more intelligent, less intelligent? I think there's a whole, with all the planets out there that we've discovered and are yet to discover, I think it would be less likely than more likely that there is an intelligent life out there, in my opinion.
Yeah, and then we've got a lot of what-if episodes that yes. That focus on alien life and focus on exoplanets and life in outer space as well. So definitely, if you're interested in that, check those out. We want to thank Jack Madden, Dr. Jack Madden, again, for joining us on today's What If Discussed about super Earths and exoplanets. And if you want more What If, you should sign up for the What If Explorers Club newsletter for tons of cool science stuff and to find out what we're doing behind the scenes here. To sign up, go to whatifshow.com. That's it for today's show. Richard?
I'm excited. Excited about the future. I mean, 2021, again, James Webb Telescope comes online. What are we going to discover? How's it going to change how we see ourselves on this planet? Who knows where the world's going to be in a year from now? That's a whole other conversation.
Oh my gosh.
But
yeah.
I like in times where we've been probably super focused in an almost negative way on what's going on in our daily lives, it was nice to escape beyond the bounds of Earth into the galaxy and beyond with guys like Dr. James Madden to be able to remember the big picture is sometimes the more important to focus on than, you know, just kind of what's in front of us.
I agree. For more big picture discussions, join us next time on What If Discussed.